third canto, chapter 9, is the section of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's prayers by Lord Brahma for creative energy. I don't think that's going to happen. He's going to want to, like, hear his own voice. He smiles a lot. Even when he's being carried around, he's smiling. Okay. Is anybody new here that, like, doesn't know who Lord Brahma is? Should I explain who Lord Brahma is? Oops, he's losing his dhoti. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 10 subject matters that are discussed. And one of them has just been completed and the other one is just about to begin. Sarga and Visarga are two of the 10. Sarga is what Lord Vishnu does and Visarga is what Lord Brahma does. Sarga is the preliminary creation and Visarga is the sub-creation. What Lord Vishnu does has been explained. And I'll just summarize. He provides the ingredients for creation because they're in a dormant state, avyakta, unmanifest state, and by his will, those energies needed for creation, he manifests them, he maintains them for some time, and then he withdraws them. But this is the phase of manifesting those energies. And those energies have some rules, like guna and karma in the Vedic way of looking at things. The living entities that are involved in material nature. In previous lifetimes, they've had some activity, and with that activity, there's an impression, like sense impression that's stored in the mind. And those impressions are not only stored in the mind, but the Supreme Personality of Godhead through his various agents also are aware of those impressions or those previous activities, and they're stored and they're going to come out after the time energy brings them out, after they fructify, just like it's a very nice season, spring season, and there are cherry blossoms all over the place in this part of the country. And besides the big, nice pink cherry blossoms, there's white and yellow and just like this whole burst of color. But after some time, that's going to change and it'll be just the green foliage of the trees. And after some time, that's going to change and it'll be fall and the leaves will change color and then they'll fall to the ground and the trees will be barren just standing there, their limbs. And then it's winter and then snow comes. And like that, the seasonal changes through the passage of time manifest different features. So this is all working under the time energy of the Supreme, and the director of that time energy is the energetic Lord Vishnu. So he manifests the elements or the material energies. He manifests like the blueprint, like, you know, the chief architect, he makes the plan, the blueprint, and then the detailed architectural plan. He doesn't need approval by a zoning board or town commissioner. He just like makes the plan. He approves the whole plan. And he produces the person who's going to put the plan together by his transcendental potency. It's described that while he's in yoga nidra, or mystic slumber, his eyes are open. He specifies his eyes are open. He's not like pretending to be asleep. He's not asleep. He's in a mystic state of, according to Sri Brahma Samhita, he's enjoying pastimes with his internal potency, Rama Devi. So, as he's in this transcendental position, having nothing to do because he has no duties, there's nothing he needs to do, the time energy moves. And at a certain point, the time energy indicates it's time for the manifestation to come into being again, because it's been in an unmanifest state for some time. And so the material elements manifest, and they manifest in a very unique way. They manifest from his navel. They manifest in the form of a little bud that's bluish in color because of the karma of the living entities that are connected to that material energy. And that little bud starts to grow and becomes a stem, and the stem manifests a lotus, and on top of the lotus is Lord Brahma. Pretty amazing. And the rest is also amazing. Lord Brahma, his body isn't made of the same elements that our body is made of. His body is made of intelligence. Imagine having a body made of intelligence. And because he's so intelligent, he does what intelligent people do. He started inquiring about self-realization. Like, who am I? Where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? What is the purpose of my existence? And he didn't like not get an answer, so he gave up. He pursued the question. And because he's very intelligent, he saw that he's seated on a lotus, and the lotus must have a stem. And so he thought, if I follow where the stem came from, I'll find out where I came from. Very reasonable. And so that's what he did. He climbed down the stem and down the stem and down the stem, and he kept climbing down and down and down, and he couldn't find the end because it's not a normal stem. Even he's not a normal being. The stem is also not normal, coming from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. How can you find the end? So then he realized, I'm not going to find out the source of my existence that way, by speculation, nor by sense investigation. These are two sources of knowledge commonly that we deploy. We see, then we think we understand by sense perception. Or we receive some understanding by intuition or by implication, by like he was doing, Anuman, by reason and logic. The reason of here's the and logic is here's this lotus, here's the stem, let me find the source of the stem and I'll find where I came from. That's very reasonable. But he couldn't find out by either method. So he went back up the stem. Now, it doesn't mention here in the third canto, it does mention in Sri Brahma Samhita and also in the second canto that while he was way down there on the stem, he heard some sound vibration. Ta-pa, ta-pa, ta-pa. So imagine if that happened to us, what would we get out of it? Probably like, what's that? But he knew what it meant because he's very intelligent. It was an instruction from the source of himself what he should do. Tapasya. austerity. And the specific austerity that he engaged in was he also heard Gayatri Mantra, not the one that everybody knows and says out loud when they're not supposed to, not that one, but another Gayatri Mantra. And so he went atop the lotus and engaged himself in fixing his mind upon that sound vibration of his Gayatri Mantra by silently in his mind concentrating on that sound. And through that concentration upon the sound, the form of the Lord who that mantra is addressing appeared before him, the Supreme Personality of Godhead just manifested before him. And there's a description of that form in detail, beautiful, beautiful description, and beautiful, beautiful form. And he was stunned with awe and veneration as to the beauty of this form of the Lord, and felt himself so fortunate, blessed by the Lord's kindness. Because he's very intelligent, he understood what he was to do. Firstly, he was to serve the Lord, but he had also been invested with creative potency, Srishti Shakti. So he was feeling this impetus to want to create, specifically to create this cosmic manifestation. That's like a big desire. We may want to create something, you know, a garden for the summer. And that's a lot of endeavor. Try it sometime. Or whatever it is that we may want to create. Somebody may want to create a computer program, or somebody may want to create something. He had this impetus to create a universe. And he felt himself incapable. And so, before undertaking that task, he's offering prayers to the Supreme Lord who appeared before him to enable him, empower him, give him the guidance, give him the protection, give him the intelligence to do this properly. So his prayers began some verses ago from what we're going to read in making very clear distinction between the Supreme Lord and his form and the tiny living entity and our perishable, frail, imperfect senses form. So in a number of different ways he was making that distinction. Then he started describing the good fortune of those souls who hear messages about the Supreme Soul, and by hearing one can perceive his presence. Specifically, he describes one can, through the sound vibration, one can smell, through sound vibration entering one's ear, one can smell the aroma of the Lord's lotus feet decorated with sandalwood paste and his transcendental fragrance. And as that form of the Lord enters into the heart through sound vibration, one feels a happiness that is incomparable. And with that happiness, one doesn't want that form of the Lord to go away. So he wants to continue to hear. And the Lord, because of the love of that devotee who wants him to be in his presence, the Lord doesn't want to go. Uh-oh. Okay. So, after describing the good fortune of those souls that like to hear, he describes the misfortune of those that don't. And describes that the very suffering that they undergo has a cure, is a remedy. And the very thing that is the remedy they don't like, and that's hearing. They won't attend gatherings or hear one is hearing about the transcendental personality of Godhead. in fact, the in place of that tendency to hear is another tendency, the tendency to enjoy the property of the Supreme Lord. The idea of enjoying the property of another, that's the mentality of a thief. And such is the mentality of those who want to be enjoyer of God's property. And as a result, they now this verse is describing how they can't see anything properly. They can't see anything properly. They can't see themselves. They can't see the space immediately around them. They can't see the world. They can't see other beings. They certainly can't see the Supreme Lord properly. And so they perpetuate their suffering by entangling themselves in fruitive activities, trying to be the enjoyers. So here's the verse. Oh my Lord, the material miseries which are without factual existence for the soul, yet as long as the conditioned soul sees the body as a means for sense enjoyment, he cannot get out of the entanglement of material miseries, being influenced by your external energy. Such non-devotees engage their senses in very troublesome and extensive work, and they suffer from insomnia at night because their intelligence constantly breaks into their sleep with various mental speculations. They are frustrated in all their various plans by supernatural power. Even great sages, if they are against your transcendental topics, must rotate in this material world. Yesterday evening at the home program that we attended, somebody came up afterwards and was asking, he was asking a question that has bothered him. Bothered him since his childhood. And he's asked different people, this is all the preamble, like the Stump the Swami question. That he's asked many persons, different teachers and yogis and Guru Maharajas and people, and gave some names of some of the people, and I don't know who those people are. And so I guess he wasn't satisfied, or just taking a poll or something like that. How many different answers can I get to this question? Probably as many people as you ask. But the question was, the living entities are struggling in material existence, and there are great personalities who are representing the Supreme Personality, and those great personalities are empowered by the Supreme Personality. Can't those great personalities kind of like just free all these conditioned souls? Is there something that can be done like that to just like let all the prisoners out of prison? So I gave a reply that seemed like went in one ear and out the other ear, but didn't seem to satisfy him. That the living entity, just where I went with that question was that even the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because here we have Lord Brahma, who is on behalf of the Supreme Personality creating that situation that he knows is going to be replete with suffering, and yet he does it. So why does God create a place where people suffer? He could do it differently. People ask that question. God is all good. God is all great. Why does he create a place where people suffer? Or, because you're asking, why don't the great souls just like let everybody out of jail? out of material existence is like a jail, like a prison. And the answer is that some persons, by nature, they break the law. Laws are there for the well-being of the society, and persons that break, I don't care for the law. You could, like, try to put them out of existence. You can't, because they're souls, so they have to have some existence, some place. So there's a place for people that are going to hurt other people and hurt themselves. And they're put in some confinement place. And that's what this world is. And there's no mandating of souls to give up their rebellious spirit and become law-abiding. There's no force, because there's free will. Then another individual is saying like this, why don't you just cut the free will? So we don't have free will, just take it away. You can willfully give it or submit it to the Supreme Lord, but it's intrinsic to the soul. And for those who... Prabhupada's example is this one. If you're looking at the light, you see light. And if you turn your back to the light, what do you see? Shadow. Very good. Shadow. You don't see light, you see shadow. What's shadow? It's the absence of light. So if someone is complaining about, hey, what's the absence of light program here? The answer is just turn to the light and there's no shadow. There may be behind you a shadow, but not in front of you. It's just light. Just turn and face the light. Yeah, but I want like light in the darkness. With my back to the supreme light, I want light. So one who wants that, they get a mirror. And there's a reflection of light only. There's a reflection of happiness only in this material world, that which appears to be happiness. The chasing after happiness in the material world is like searching for water in a desert. Hint, in deserts, there's no water. But it may look like there's water. It's called a mirage. Mirage is the sun shining on the silicon, the sand, and in such an angle, it may look like water. And so you go chasing the water in a place where there's no water, in the desert. By definition, there's no water in a desert. And by design, there's no happiness in this material world. But there's the reflection of it. There's the absence of light, but there's the reflection of light. And it's a perverted reflection. At that, just like in the outside mirrors of cars, they're convex, and they tell you right on the mirror, objects may look closer than they are. So beware. Because it's not an exact, you know, flat image. But even the flat image, it's not like the car is in your mirror. The reflection of the light of the car behind you is in the mirror. So real happiness exists, just like the car and the light from the car exists, but the reflection is not, there's no substance in a reflection. If it's time for prasadam, we have a nice mirror and say, here's some food that we've offered to Krishna, but you can't touch that. You can just take that what's in the mirror. Serve yourself. There's no substance in the reflection in the mirror. No one will be satisfied eating the reflection of food in the mirror. These verses, because, and Brahma certainly knows, because he's going to have to create this place. So he knows like all the tricks. He knows all the technologies of the whole thing. And what that technology does is, there's this nice verse similar to what Brahma's saying in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, the instructions of Rishabhdev to his sons, the 100 sons of Rishabhdev headed by Bharat Maharaj. Fifth chapter, you can look up that verse, the series of verses. They're so nice and so important that during Srila Prabhupada's time in our Gurukul in Vrindavan, I remember the children would line up each morning before they began their classes, and they would recite these verses by Rishabhdev, like really loud, all ensemble, all the kids. So one of them is Paravastavat Abodajato Navanyagasita Atmatatvam Yavat Kriyastavat Idam Madovai Karmatmakam Yena Sharira Bandha. It says the same thing as what Brahma is saying, but the message is, as long as one holds on to the bodily conception of life, then his intentions, if you have the misconception of I, then you're going to have the misconceptions of mine. It goes like this. If I think I am this body, then what falls in the category of mine is what's produced from this body. So what's produced from this body? My work. So that which is produced from my work is mine. Like, so either, let's say I'm a carpenter and I cut down a tree and take the tree and use my implements and make a nice altar like this, like bookcase and piece of furniture. Because I made it, it's mine. Now I take it to the marketplace and sell it, and when I sell it, I get my other necessities, some rice and some vegetables and some this and some that and whatever else I may need, because that's mine, because it came from me. So it's either the work, or the modern system is not the bartering system, it's currency. So my paycheck, that's mine. And then the things that my paycheck buys, that's also mine. My car, my house, my iPad, my refrigerator, my shoes, my mortgage payment, my taxes, mine. Because it came from this body, it's mine. And then my family, my children, my relatives, my society, my community, mine. I and mine. What Rishabhdev is saying is, as long as one is in the bodily conception, that thinking in that way, in terms of the body to be the self and the instrument for enjoying, then one will be caught in that deluding sense of who I really am and what my real happiness is will elude you. It'll be gone. As long as you engage in yavat kriyas, if you engage in fruitive activity, tavat idam manovai, one's mana, one's mind, will be karmatmakam, colored with fruitive intention. Just like these light bulbs, because they're in a, here's this one, it's in a nice, like, whatever they call it, tinted, colored glass. But supposing it was pink, supposing it was green or blue or orange or some other color, the room would be filled with that color. Although the filament inside, or the place that's emanating the light, isn't that color. But because the lens covering it is colored, the light coming out will be that color. So similarly, the consciousness of the soul is pure, but covered. And when, because of the covering, we see according to that covering. We don't see things as they are, we see according to the covering. We see rose with rose-colored glasses, and yellow with yellow-colored glasses, and green with green-colored glasses. We see according to the covering of our consciousness. And when there's fruitive intention, through fruitive work, we're bound not only to not seeing things the way they are, but we're bound to the reaction, the binding force of acting in that way. So Rishabhdev's advice to his sons is, don't make that mistake. There is an alternative, although the mistake option, that mode is prevalent, almost universal, but there is another option. And the option is to withdraw one's consciousness from that material conception of the body and understand one's identity as the soul. It's so basic. I'll share something else here. Maybe some of you have read the summarization of Chaitanya Charitamrita and Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam by Purnaprajna. Have you read those? Purnaprajna's writings? He's a godbrother of mine. We joined within a month's time at the Boston Temple. It was the summer of 1970, and he and his wife Narayani came about a month after I did, and they were living in the temple shortly after, or at least full-time engaged in service. And then some time passed, and I went to New York, and you know, they went to India, and our lives went separate directions. But he was always very brahminical, as was his wife. She was a pujari in the Calcutta temple for years, and then so many things happened. Went through Vrindavan. So he's written, you know, gone through the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srimad Bhagavatam in a concise form, Mahabharata in a simple form. I mean, that's massive work. Explaining it so it's, you know, simple. So I just saw him in Mayapur. I hadn't seen him for a long time. In fact, he was surprised that I even recognized him. He definitely looked a little older, but I recognized him. And I asked him, how's he doing? He said, do you recognize me? Purnaprajna. Yeah, Purnaprajna. Okay, so we took prasadam together, and I asked him what's going on with his life, and he said, he has this, after all of that work, he has this very strong desire to present seminars, especially to young people, meaning their thought process is more flexible, and start with ABC, like, you're not this body, you're spirit soul. Because by, and go through with them slowly, step by step, if you think otherwise, here's the downstream consequences of thinking other than your spirit soul. And it's not a pretty picture when you look at it very, you know, bare bones. And then the conception of I am spirit soul, what is that conception and where does it go? And step by step, where does it go? And then, you know, like over a period of time through seminars, help them make the discrimination between the real identity and the false identity. Because if we don't make that proper discrimination, we're in material existence. Even many good people will suffer in material existence. The root cause of suffering. Do, 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 do. The root cause of suffering is ignorance. Ignorance. And what is that? The essence of that ignorance is accepting yourself to be somebody that you're not. And trying to be happy through something that you're not. You're not going to be happy through something that you're not. And you suffer. So to remove that ignorance is the greatest mercy, but it's also the greatest challenge, because people are very, very, very invested in the misconception. Take away something and they panic. Oh, where's my happiness gone? Like an object of happiness, and it's gone. This just happened. I was traveling, believe it or not, from Boston to Chicago, and the airlines that I was traveling with received two bags and only one came out. So I went to the office, and you know, people are ranting and raving and tearing their hair out and screaming at the people that they're really trained up to, like, you know, whoa. And I didn't do any of that. So they commented, you know, you're not screaming at us like everybody does. What's with you? Anyway, I got the suitcase back yesterday. 3 weeks later, I got the suitcase back. But in between, it wasn't like, oh, how am I going to live without my suitcase? You know, there are things in there that I needed, but I, you know, just, okay. Something happened, whatever. And I honestly thought that somebody stole the suitcase. And, you know, but what I had in the suitcase is nothing they could use. It really doesn't have any particular monetary value for them, but it has like a sloka book that is out of print now. I can't get another one. Really? Anyway, some medicines, and what are they going to do with my medicines? Things that I need, but, you know, doesn't mean anything to them. So I thought they might bring it back, but they didn't bring it back. But if something is gone that you even, you know, your health, because there's some health items in there that I need, just what are you going to do? Wail and whine and complain and fret and get angry and blame somebody, or, you know, it was interesting to watch my mind. It didn't even go there. I didn't have to like hold it back from going there. It just didn't go there. And I was wondering, how does something like that happen? And it's only in part it's training, but it's also a satisfaction in something else, a satisfaction within. And then, so in that state, the dualities of so-called happiness followed by the other feature of that duality, distress, because the something you have is then taken away, that then one becomes distressed. So if one's happiness is within, then you can act in a responsible way in dealing with the world around you, but not your happiness is dependent upon which configuration of matter it is today. And because tomorrow it's going to change. And then I'm distressed. If it's happiness today, it's distress tomorrow. If it's distress today, it's happiness tomorrow. I admit it was a relief to get the suitcase back. That means I didn't have to go through the step-by-step of replacing the things that were in it, these replaceable parts. But, you know, it's this service or that service from a position perspective of a devotee. There's varieties of service for a devotee to do. That's what life is, varieties of service. Krishna's making this arrangement, Krishna's making that arrangement for varieties of service. You can't sustain that consciousness. The point of the Bhagavatam verse is you can't sustain that consciousness if you're identifying the self in terms of the body. And the reason is because we want happiness. And if I am this body, then happiness is dependent upon I and mine in terms of the body. And the equation doesn't end up in happiness. It's not sustainable. And it's not even that intended sense of happiness. The sense is contacting some object, and when contact with the object, there's the idea that's happiness. That's not happiness. And then even that is gone. It's like the mirror, and then you tilt the mirror, and the reflection is gone. You can't even see it. It's gone. It's gone. But it wasn't. The verse is specifically saying, to begin with, it's illusion. The miseries, the good news is, the miseries are also illusion. The material miseries are without factual existence for the soul. Yet, as long as the conditioned soul sees the body as meant for sense enjoyment, he cannot get out of the entanglement of material miseries, being influenced by your external energy. So they have to do something else. What do they do? What's the something else they do? Such non-devotees engage their senses in very troublesome and extensive work. Fruitive activity is intense endeavor to achieve something. Somebody last night was, a point that they were stuck on was, which is better, to be forgiving or to win? The first he was his asking was, what's the cause of anger? Anger is where there's contact with the mode of passion, desire. When desire is frustrated, anger. So anger has as the root cause contact with the mode of passion, giving rise to desires. When desires are frustrated, anger. So, what to do was the next question. So, one of the statements of Bhishma Dev is the antidote for anger is forgiveness. If you're feeling angry towards someone, you practice forgiveness. So then his next question went, which is better, win or forgive? Because, you know, how can you live without having a desire to achieve something? You're dead. Don't have a desire to achieve something. So that means win. And is it better to forgive than to win? Which is better? So, but the part that he couldn't get was the next answer, because he got all the other stuff. But if you make your desire Krishna's desire, then winning is better. But if you make your desire something that's apart from Krishna, that means it's illusion. Better to forgive. And he just kept going back. Which is better, to win or to forgive? Because if you can't go to the place where it's the spiritual conception, where the real happiness is the soul, is serving the Supreme Soul, and the body is directed towards that activity also, engaging the senses in the service of the master of the senses, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam, Bhaktir Uchite. That's winning, because Krishna wins. And all the bells ring. Victory. Param Vijayate. And if you don't have that program, then you have the other one. The passion program, where it's desire, intense endeavor to achieve something. And that Rishabhdev is teaching, Yavat kriyas tavat idam manovai. The mana, the mind, becomes disturbed, agitated, just bite. Boom, boom. Like dominoes. Boom, boom, boom. The whole thing falls. The plan for happiness collapses. And it's like children. You just set up the dominoes, then tap one, and they all collapse, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. And do it again, and just like lifetime after lifetime, just keep doing it. I just have to set them up properly, that's all. I know I can do it. It's like those little puzzles, I forget what you call them. Rubik's Square? Just like, you know, so I've seen people in the airport, they're just like the whole time. Waiting for the plane, on the plane, getting off the plane. They're just like mesmerized with the Rubik's Square, trying to get all the colors lined up. Or people playing solitaire on their, you know, computers or their little handheld devices. Like, you know, the whole time. These are like, you know, guys in business suits playing solitaire. I don't get it. If you win, you lose, and if you lose, you lose. But that's the circumstance that's being described by Lord Brahma, and he knows because he has to create the universe. Those that are devoid of an attraction for the transcendental messages are going to have another attraction, and that other attraction, intense endeavor to achieve it, that brings disturbance of the mind. Idam manovai. They are frustrated in their various plans by supernatural powers. Supernatural powers meaning beyond their control, there's controllers. And they may think that they're in control, and whatever is they're in control of, it changes. Beyond their control. They're frustrated. Even great sages, if they are against your transcendental topics, must rotate in the material world. So where this is all headed is, Brahma is going to ask for the creative potency to create this place that he knows what it's like, but he's also going to want, like, you know, the escape hatch. What's the button to press to get out of that circumstance? I want to give that to the inhabitants in this realm that I'm going to be creating. So the Lord gives him transcendental knowledge and, like, you know, empowerment to distribute that transcendental knowledge, along with creating the place where it's the house of correction and the house of detention, both. The correction is the real purpose of creation. And with the Vedas, with creation comes this transcendental knowledge. So we should, as soon as we recognize it, take advantage of the transcendental knowledge that comes along with the package called the material world. Like the operating instructions. Like these little devices, I can't figure them out, but, you know, kids, they can... Really, they don't even need instructions. They just, like, play with it and figure it out. So, with the material creation comes an operator's manual called the Vedas. And it tells us how to live our lives in this place according to the indications of the Creator, the Supreme. And we follow that method, and it gradually lifts our consciousness to the spiritual plane and then to the transcendental plane, how to engage ourselves in loving service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead eternally. That's the desire of Lord Brahma, that he feels not only he can't do the creation properly, he wants that also to be given to him, that facility, that license, that empowerment. And as householders, you're creating houses and families and relations, and the same interest should also be there. The scale is different, but the principle is the same. How to take up this activity of family life in such a way that the real purpose is served, not just the temporary, illusory bondage purpose is served, but the spiritual conception, the real ultimate purpose is served. With that inquisitive spirit, the answer, when given, strikes your heart. And if that inquisitive spirit isn't there, we stay stuck. Even the great sages rotate in material existence without that proper understanding, spiritual conception of life. Okay, so any questions or comments anyone like to make? Yeah.
If a person is said to be in a particular mode, under the influence of...
If what has to be in a particular mode?
Then a person is said to be under the influence of a particular mode.
Every person is under the influence of some mode, and that's always changing.
And it's always changing. So, the soul proper is nothing to do with...
That's
the
right. Soul has nothing to do with the modes of nature.
So, which is... but in the mind, intelligence of
false ego.
False ego.
The false ego is the agency by which the soul improperly, mistakenly accepts wrong identity. That's the agency. That's the gear. You just pull that lever and you're an illusion. And without false ego, we don't have a problem. We have correct ego. There's correct sense of self. But it's so subtle that it just rules and governs and dominates all the other components. Yes. Yes, interesting, isn't it? Yes. You're repeating in reverse order. The answer is yes. His body is intelligence. Intelligence is subtle. His body is subtle. He can appear, if he wants to, for those of us that have not such subtle eyes. He's very powerful, but that's his body. Think of the beginning of the creation, when he just thinks thoughts and things come into being by those thoughts. Then he casts away the thought, and that by so doing, he casts away that body. But then he doesn't like become unembodied. Just gives up that thought. It's not like one of these. Yes.
Subtle body is false ego, mind and illusions.
Correct.
So when we become liberated, the subtle body goes away.
It's dissolved.
So right now, the process of Krishna consciousness is understanding the soul beyond the body. So how does the subtle body purify the subtle body? How does
Well, the good news is there's a spiritual mind and spiritual intelligence and a spiritual ego. Does that solve the riddle?
Yes.
And what's driving the material as this question, what's it's like you put your hand inside a glove and wiggle your fingers, what happens? The glove wiggles. You take your hand out of the glove, the fingers don't wiggle. So, by false ego, the grosser elements, intelligence and mind, and then the body, they move. Kapila Dev describes to Devahuti that by the process of devotional service, the material mind becomes dissolved. What a relief, huh? Like, no more? No more. Not even like, you come back for another bout. Just like, no more. Dissolved. Like Alka-Seltzer, just drop it in a tablet and fizzes and it's gone. But it's not even like that, it's gone. It's not like dissolved in water, it's gone. It's just matter. But behind that is the spiritual mind. Then the spiritual mind becomes operative. That spiritual mind is man-mana, always thinking of Krishna, desiring, thinking, feeling, and willing functions of the mind in relation to Krishna. That's a spiritual mind. And that's so satisfying. There's no need for the material mind anymore. It just dissolves. But as long as the desire is separate from Krishna, then we need a material mind. behind the material mind is the spiritual mind. Behind the material intelligence is the spiritual intelligence. Behind the false ego is the soul, the true sense of self. So the program is to get in that space, the spiritual space, where it's spiritual intelligence, spiritual mind, spiritual sense of identity, and serve Krishna. We can then use the gross and subtle body, but in course of using them, they become purified, and eventually, they're not needed anymore. But a spiritual body with spiritual mind, intelligence, and sense of identity is manifest. Narada describes that in the first canto of the Bhagavatam to Vyasadeva in his previous life, where he was serving the Bhaktivedantas and he received mantra from them and so forth. And at the end of his life, it doesn't say as lightning and thunder, but as lightning illumination occurs simultaneously. His previous body was given up and his spiritual body was manifested. So prior to that moment of death, the spiritual consciousness is restored and the body just falls off. But the normal, a conditioned soul, the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and false ego materially tainted, carry the soul to the next situation because there's material desire and all kinds of karma and modes of nature things going on. But when all that's dissolved, the spiritual body is manifest at once. No delay, at once. And even in this lifetime, one can experience that the presence of spiritual consciousness and in that state, the diminished influence of material consciousness progressively to zero. In the beginning, there's practice, there's sadhana. We practice chanting, hearing, remembering, worship, praying. And in the maturing stages, just like Brahma was describing, that the person who has matured in that process, they experience something. The Lord is manifesting himself in my heart, or in this case, directly before him. And they don't want anything else. They don't want to go play like children, or go do some fruitive thing, or go chase after some sense gratification. They're someone who can offer that to them, and it's no thank you. No thank you. They're satisfied. Anything else? Yes?
Maharaj, yesterday, it's a continuation of the question which you answered yesterday about anger.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that we should come to to pure goodness. At least we should try to come to pure goodness.
Yes.
In process of even practicing, chanting and everything, but still you don't reach that point and my passion, I feel like my passion gets increased and it's becoming more worse and more angry. How do I overcome it? In process of still practicing it, I'm not able to reach that point, but my passion is also increasing. Anger, I get frustrated. Anger or stuff like that.
I would then recommend that you look more attentively and carefully and refine how you're taking up the process of chanting in particular. And specifically, where is your attention while chanting? Because Prabhupada gives this example, when you put water into a garden, what grows? whenever there's seeds in the garden, that's what grows. So the thing that you want to grow, that will grow, and the weeds will also grow. So what do you do when you're gardening? You don't not water the garden. You water the garden and you pull out the weeds. You water the garden, you pull out the weeds, and eventually the seeds of the weeds are gone and it's just the thing that you want. But you have to be attentive, gardener. Otherwise you'll have a garden full of weeds. And they grow faster. Because, so it's due to a previous material contact with the motive passion that those other things are coming out. Not the process, but be attentive to the creeper that you want to grow, and while you're chanting, as far as possible, strive for that attentiveness to the devotion to Krishna, natural feature of the soul, and remove the weeds. Not just like clip them, but remove at the root, because otherwise they'll come again, come again, come again. Just clip them, they'll come again. Remove them. Put in your compost pile. Be a good gardener when you're chanting.
By sharing Krishna consciousness with others, come across a few people who stop at the point of identifying oneself as the soul, spirit soul, that's it. They couldn't go beyond that. So we are discussing right now about the spiritual mind, spiritual intelligence and spiritual identity. They are not able to even come to that stage. So is it like an impersonal conception? That
yeah. Where does impersonal conception originate from?
In the operation.
Yeah, an attitude. I don't mind spirituality as long as I'm not accountable to anybody. I'm accountable to somebody, you know, I'm uncomfortable. I value my freedom. And freedom means I'm not accountable to anybody. You put somebody I'm accountable to in front of me and I've got you just hit my button. I got an issue over there. That's the why, and then what to do. The Bhagavatam provides the medicine or the remedy. It's attractive messages of the personality of Godhead that even the impersonalists become attracted to, although they may become attracted to with an impersonal conception. But the spiritual potencies are there, that nashta prayeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya. If one hears from the proper sources, then even the audience is filled with impersonalism and voidism. The message is filled with spiritual potency. So that light is stronger than the darkness. So the remedy depends upon the purity of the transmitter of that message. So if we have some real concern, the concern should go to how to become more pure so we can vibrate that message more effectively. Anything else? Yes?
Happiness and distress we experience with the senses is illusion. I wanted to understand what that means. Number one,
I want to understand what your question is.
Yeah, you were saying that whatever we experience, happiness or distress, is only illusion, is not real.
Okay.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? It means, let's just do one at a time before we go to the next one. I used an example. Well, you use the example of the mirror, and let's make it really simple. Here's an apple, and here's a mirror. and in the mirror is the reflection of the apple. So is there any nourishment available in that reflection of the apple? Looks like an apple, but there's no nourishment there. And now I go like this with the mirror. What happened? The apple just disappeared. But the apple didn't disappear. The reflection of the apple disappeared. There's no substance in a reflection. Similarly, this world is a reflection, just as it's stated in Bhagavad Gita, a reflection of the spiritual world. There's an apple tree, and there's a reflection of the apple tree in the lake. So I'm hungry, so I just take a handful of, you know, the apple that's in the reflection of the water. All I get is a handful of water. I don't get an apple. The happiness, oh, I'm going to have some nourishment. And the distress, oh, it's just a handful of water. They're both illusion. The substance is elsewhere. And the comparison is, that's a senses contacting a sense object only. Can we remove that picture so I can see his? There we go. Okay, there you are. That which is real is enduring or sat. So that which is here in a moment and gone in the next moment, that's asat. It's like, you know, the magician that pulls the rabbit out of the hat. And they'll show the audience, see the hat? There's nothing in the hat. They pull the hat inside and out, and there's nothing in the hat. And they reach in and pull out a rabbit out of the hat. And everyone goes, yay, and then puts the rabbit back in the hat. The rabbit disappears. What was that? It's a magician's trick. So that which appears and then disappears, it's insubstantial. That's the happiness one feels from eating the apple. It's on the platform of the body, which is temporary. The sensation is temporary. The satisfaction of one's hunger is temporary. And then wait a while and you're hungry again. So where's the satisfaction? It just went away. And in fact, it's not what real satisfaction is. Real satisfaction is sat, it's enduring. It's eternal. That's reality is eternal. And illusion is now you see it, now you don't. Temporary. Very fundamental difference with it in the morning Bhagavatam verse at the temple was Varuna having an encounter with Krishna and his father, Nanda Maharaj. So coming up, read this long purport where Krishna is contemplating how the elders of Vrindavan are thinking about their future. By associating with this young boy, we may get a great destination in our next life. So in the purport is this very wonderful discussion about Maya, Mahamaya, and Yogamaya. It's a very fundamental part of our devotional understanding. Like, what's the difference between illusion and reality? And for a devotee, the reality is very, you know, in a very foundational level, very basic level, it's eternal. Like, who am I? I'm spirit soul. Well, I don't see spirit soul. I see the body, therefore I'm this body. I'm from that, you know, I see it, I believe it place. So this is what I see, and I don't see the soul, so I don't believe in the soul. But, you know, the body is, it wasn't, then it is, and then it's gone. It's asat. It's not who I am. There's something that endures even when the body changes. That's who I am. That's sat, unchanging. So all those experiences having to do with the body, they're asat. Insubstantial, like the reflection, not enduring. There's no substance there. Or you can find the same discussion in the first purport of Srimad Bhagavatam, substance and category. Plato talks about it. I mean, it's a fundamental philosophical issue. What is substantial and what is insubstantial? The materialist has a reverse opposite perspective from a devotee or a transcendentalist. For them, that which is concrete, that's substantial. And something that's not concrete, it's insubstantial. Why are you chasing after this insubstantial? For the devotee, it's the opposite. Spirit is substantial, and this is, now you see it, now you don't. It's insubstantial. You accept what necessities require by God's provision, but your happiness should not be in terms of how much of that you have or don't have. Invest your attention in what's substantial. And for the materialist, that's a waste of time. We're wasting our time. We could be out enjoying. And we're thinking differently. We're doing that which is substantial, not wasting our time in chasing after illusion. That which is reflection only and has no substance. And a little tilt of the mirror, the mind, and it's horrible. Hankering and lamenting. Kamesha, Kronesha. Yes.
Happiness, Krishna says happiness and distress need to be tolerated.
So happiness and distress do what?
Need to be tolerated.
Need to be tolerated. That's the happiness and distress that are demanded by the senses. That feature of duality, tolerated.
And that comes with this conception, I'm a spirit soul, so these are temporary.
Yeah, when you tolerate that, you put your consciousness somewhere else. It's not like, don't do that, but what do? If you withdraw consciousness from that arena, where do you invest consciousness? You invest consciousness in sat. So, what's under the category of sat? Lots. Okay? Anything else? Okay. Yes?
You're telling me about removing the weeds.
Removing?
Weeds in the garden.
Weeds in the garden, okay.
So how do we really remove it from us? Like, they keep coming.
They keep coming. You keep pulling. You ever done gardening? Ask a gardener that has done it like for a long time. It's part of gardening. Yeah. Well, keep gardening. As long as it takes. And incrementally, as our devotion grows, the purity of devotion will, of its own accord and naturally, diminish the capacity of the weed to grow. Just like if you have a very strong, healthy, robust tree, or start when it's little, there's all this other stuff. But when it's like, it takes all the water, so that the weeds have less chance to grow. By the strength of, it's not a completely effective comparison, but when our devotion becomes very strong and mature, it's not, now we can be inattentive, it's all right. But the strength of devotion, it carries with it that, not wishing something material to enter. Like Jamunacharya's verse where he says, now that I have experienced the happiness of the presence of the personality of Godhead, in loving and devotion, those former desires, that remembrances of former material involvement, when that comes into my mind, my lips automatically curl and I spit on the thought. Out. So you still keep a rubbish bin, but you know, it's like you're not preoccupied with it. In the beginning, you have to be very attentive. Particularly attentive. Okay. Hare Krishna. Yes? Sampath?
When you were discussing about we need to be very attentive to chanting and we need to remove the weeds.
Same question?
But what do the weeds in this sense means? Other thoughts that come by chanting?
Etc. Desires, you know, tendencies, material tendencies that arise. So like, again, this thing of sense activity gives sense perception. Some image goes into the mind. Because, you know, when we're, every moment we're doing something and our senses are alert, and those impressions of our senses, like, you know, the fan is blowing. So I, you know, the, whatever, if there's, something is happening. The sense impression is stored. Time passes. The time energy brings that stored impression into a enlivened state or activated state again, where there's some desire for something related or a thought, as you're saying. It's not necessarily something from outside, it's something from some past activity. So we normally, in material consciousness, that summation of past activities and desires impel us to do things, whatever those things are. And in spiritual life, because we're engaged in devotional practice, it has the potency is there to remove those tendencies. But there has to be some willingness on our part, some attentiveness and willingness. Do we not act on those things and we instead bring our attention to sat? Like this example of the spiritual mind and spiritual intelligence. Stay active in that realm and don't invest in the illusory one. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Hare Krishna. See the Prabhupada.
Yeah. Yeah.